This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, December 2nd, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. It may come as some surprise to learn that the prohibition of alcohol has been tried in many parts of the world. The results, though, are in many ways exactly what you would expect. That's according to author Mark Schrod. The book is Smashing the Liquor Machine. We spoke last month. When you hear descriptions of American prohibition, and your book goes into the experiences of attempts of differing quality of prohibition around the world, what do most Americans either not understand, or what do they understand that is just incorrect?
Well, there's a whole lot that goes to it. I think at the core of it, though, is that it's been positioned and repositioned so many times into something of a sort of cultural politics that, you know, prohibitionists were Bible thumpers, moralizing, you know, who wanted to take away your freedom to drink and tell you what thou shalt and shalt not drink and do with your lives. So for a long time, I was curious about, you know, the conventional wisdom for prohibition. Again, my focus is not so much as an American historian or anything along those lines. You know, my interest is in comparative history and Russian history and whatnot. So when it comes to the conventional wisdom of why we had prohibition in this country, again, the usual explanation is that it was about sort of Midwestern evangelical Bible thumpers. It's sort of this cultural backlash against modernization and immigration. They see it as a very reactionary movement. I was like, okay, well, you know, again, my background being in sort of European politics and Russian politics in particular, I was like, wait a minute, you know, this isn't the only country where you had prohibition. You had around 12 countries around the globe and many more trying different, you know, variations of alcohol control. So I was like, you know, if we just kind of put our conventional wisdom aside about American politics and look at what prohibition was like in the rest of the world, you get a completely different understanding. It was, in many cases, if you're looking at Russia, if you're looking at Sweden, if you're looking at Germany, Austro-Hungarian Empire, it was, in all these cases, sort of a very progressive movement to rein in the excesses of what they saw as the worst excesses of predatory capitalism, the idea of getting people, hooked on alcohol and then effectively bleeding them dry. So it gets tied in with sort of anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, anti-big business movement in all these different areas. And so that was kind of the impetus for this whole thing. It was like trying to figure out, okay, what was prohibition like in the rest of the world? And then the hope was maybe, you know, in chapter 8 of a 200-page book that, you know, maybe there'd be some insights for what we could learn from the American perspective. It was at that point in time, I concluded the research and whatnot. And sat down with some colleagues of mine here in the department, and they said, okay, if this is true, if what you're telling me is true, that prohibition in the rest of the world was kind of this movement for indigenous self-rights and protections against sort of the worst excesses of predatory capitalism and this imperial state that kind of benefits from the drunken debauchery of their own people, a colleague of mine said, okay, where are the Native Americans in your account? Where are they? And I was like, oh, you're right. They're not there. I don't have any. So that one question kind of is what added 8 more chapters onto this book, because it forced me to kind of take this framework and approach American history from. And when you start to look at it through that, you start to recognize that, you know, prohibition has much deeper roots in the United States than just the 18th Amendment. It goes back, I guess, even predates the founding of the United States. If you look at Native Americans, African Americans.
A friend of mine, Anthony Comegna, who has appeared on this podcast a number of times, clued me into a book called The Alcoholic Republic, which you note as one of the inspirations for some of the work that you did in your book, Smashing the Liquor Machine. And that book goes into some pretty clear detail about the sort of galling extent to which alcohol was consumed on a daily basis by average Americans from the founding era up through, up through at least the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of alcohol that's being consumed, partly because of the realities, there are no really good alternatives, right? So, stream water could be contaminated. You could get, bacterial infections. One of the safest things that you could drink was, an alcoholic, sort of mildly fermented beverage. As a consequence, the founding of this country was steeped in alcohol use and abuse. Many of the founding fathers were either involved in alcohol production themselves. Others were involved in sort of decrying the negative externalities that came of it, the crime and drunkenness, that came of that. So there's a very rich history of American drunkenness, as it were, straight through. But what's interesting about the Rohrbach book is that, the levels of alcohol consumption that we had at sort of the founding of the United States drop off precipitously well before what we would consider to be the Prohibition era. They kind of drop off, in the 1830s, 1840s, rather significantly. And that's many cases due to the influence of early temperance organizations and so sort of the Washingtonian societies and kind of these self-help communities that even Alexis de Tocqueville talks about in his book on America. He sees this as one of the foundational virtues of American society civil society, are these self-help communities where people are coming together to wean themselves off of alcohol and alcoholism in the interest not only of their own self-betterment, but of the betterment of their entire communities as well.
You said that you were a little bit confused by a lot of the stories that were told about Prohibition, at least with regard to the American experience. Give us a sense of where these other efforts occurred around the world and what the timeframes were.
Well, what's interesting and what got me into this area of interest to begin with was kind of the recognition that right around World War I, that's sort of the era that we have American Prohibition. But that's also the kind of this wave of international prohibitions all at about the same time. So you get, prohibitions in countries like, the Russian Empire under the Tsars, in Iceland and Norway. You get it in vast swaths of colonial Africa and India. You get it in the Ottoman Empire and sort of secular Turkey. And so that became sort of the puzzle. It's like, wait a minute. From a political science perspective, what is the logic? Because my working assumption, all this was that, and this became the title of my first book, was, the political power of bad ideas. As I began with this working assumption that prohibition is a bad idea, that it begets all these negative externalities. You get the scofflaws, you get the disrespect for law and order, you get the Al Capones of the world and all these sorts of things. And these were all things that you could reasonably foresee, right? But from a sort of politics perspective and political science perspective, there was no logical reason for it. Right. So if you want to call it a bad idea or a suboptimal policy outcome, there's no logical reason for a lot of countries to adopt a well-known bad idea all at the same time or around the same time. Right. So the idea is that, political science is that, if you have a good, effective public policy, then other countries will emulate that. But it's based upon the notion that, it does what it's supposed to and it alleviates the societal harm. So there was really no logical reason for that. So that's what kind of got me into this this notion. But what you find is that, kind of working your way backwards from the World War I era, is that in countries around the globe and including the United States, the roots of this movement, not against alcohol per se, but against what they called the liquor traffic. And I think that's a very important distinction between liquor as, the stuff in the bottle
versus the liquor traffic, which is, you know, sort of making money off of people's drunkenness in that particular case. That was, you know, very deep rooted and in many cases around the globe. And you really start to see it come into very stark relief when you look at places like colonial South Africa, when you look at the Belgians in the Congo, when you look at the British in sort of their colonial domination in India, and even sort of with the opium wars in China, where you have the same sorts of dynamics of sort of an imperial power bringing in sort of a high powered liquors, whiskeys, rums, that sort of stuff, where there's no native or indigenous tradition of that sort of alcohol consumption, using it to get people addicted and then making that as something that has sort of a self-renewing, self-perpetuating demand for those wares. So once you start to recognize that and stop seeing prohibition as kind of this one-off thing when you're talking about alcohol politics is something that you can kind of segregate off and study up on the shelf with cookbooks and whatnot, you start to recognize how completely endemic it is to all sorts of elements in different global history and American history as well. So even going back to American history, there's a reason why we had a whiskey rebellion in this country, right? It wasn't just because people really liked to drink. It was because whiskey was a vital component in American commerce at the time of the founding of the United States.
How did these attempts at prohibition resolve? We know in the American experience, we saw, a massive increase in organized crime. We saw, beer virtually disappear, being replaced by spirits of dubious quality in many cases. How did it work out in these other countries like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example?
Pretty much the same. I think those dynamics are fairly universal. In fact, the United States was one of the last countries to repeal it, repeal their prohibitions. Some countries, it was only sort of a temporary wartime measure lasting through World War I. Finland was probably the other big holdout lasting until the late 20s, early 1930s. But it has something to do with sort of the stickiness of decision-making and policy-making in the United States, where, you had these prohibitionists getting, the 18th Amendment ratified into the Constitution, from which point nothing had ever been repealed from the Constitution. So they were kind of fairly well assured in themselves that this was going to be a permanent fixture of American politics. Well, it took 13 years, but eventually it does ultimately become repealed in the United States, and it kind of fails in all these different countries for the exact same reasons, right? You get the disrespect for law and order, you get organized crime, you get these black markets elements that are going on, so to some degree, the United States was kind of the last of this global wave to finally remedy what looks to be this error in terms of alcohol control policy.
Yeah, I've said in the past that at least lawmakers at the time of American prohibition at least had the good manners to try to put it into the Constitution, unlike drug prohibition in the United States. To the extent you can, what are the parallels between, as you mentioned, opium wars, alcohol, and drugs, particularly in the U.S. experience? What are the cleanest parallels that you can draw?
That's a good question, and I'll preface this by usually stating that my interests in terms of the research and everything that I was doing was kind of more historically focused. That I was interested in figuring out what was happening back then, because it really didn't make a whole lot of sense to me in the present, that we would have, this prohibitionist movement, and have this kind of stain in the Constitution, to have, this 18th Amendment go in and then sort of, the 21st Amendment has to come through and kind of erase the 18th. And that in itself to me was curious. I'm like, how did that even happen? That was my interest. But from that kind of comes the question of how do we wrap our minds around what was motivating these temperance people, these prohibitionists back in the day? And I think, to get to your question, the probably clearest present day example isn't necessarily, the war on drugs, and isn't necessarily the, what we have with marijuana and medicinal marijuana and everything that kind of comes with that. I think the clearest parallel is the opioid crisis in the United States. I'd written an op-ed on the centennial of prohibition a number of years ago, and this was in the New York Times and whatnot, trying to say, okay, well, how is it that we wrap our minds around these temperance members? And I think that if you look at the opioid epidemic, that's probably the clearest example. So my argument was this: it was essentially, okay, if you look at the opioid epidemic in the United States, and you look at places like Big Pharma, right? If you look at Purdue Pharmaceuticals, that is essentially knowingly getting people addicted to a highly addictive substance, and then, essentially sucking them dry, and entire communities dry, and making massive profits for it. If that's okay with you, well, then that's okay with you. But if you think that there's something problematic with that, and maybe there should be some regulations on that. And I was like, well, congratulations. 100 years ago, you were probably, marching in the ranks of the temperance movement, which wasn't necessarily a bad thing, right? It was just kind of a recognition that there were limits to be put on, this highly addictive substance, and recognizing that there might be a role for some degree of regulation of that market.
What was the relationship, to the extent you can draw it out, at least in the American experience, between the advocacy for the 18th Amendment and advocacy for the 19th Amendment? If I recall correctly, they were adopted nationally at pretty close to contemporaneously.
Right. And that's another interesting area where there's a lot of mythologizing and myth-making that kind of comes of it. Obviously, the 18th Amendment comes before the 19th Amendment with women's suffrage. It's fascinating to me to sort of watch Twitter exchanges and things that happen online where people roundly accuse women of kind of foisting prohibition on men in the United States, which is fascinating given the overriding nature of prohibitionism and the fact that women didn't have the right to vote yet at that point in time. That said, obviously, as you find, with things like the Women's Christian Temperance Union, Frances Willard, is kind of one of the motivating factors behind that. There was a very strong connection between, temperance and prohibitionism and the women's rights movement. Because the argument was that, again, if you go into the 19th century, women didn't have the right to vote. They didn't have not only the right to the vote, but, didn't have political liberties, didn't have civil liberties, didn't have economic rights. And so once you got married, essentially, everything that you had as a woman was subordinate to that of your husband. And so if you happened to marry a guy who ends up getting ensnared into to the clutches of the saloon, as they would say, or gets addicted to alcohol and then gets sucked dry, well, next thing you know, you're out of a house, you're out of a job, or you're out of a livelihood, based upon no fault of your own. And so the argument was, for women, was that this was kind of home protection. I guess that was the rallying cry of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, was that we need to have temperance and prohibition because otherwise we're being subject to the whims of, the ups and downs of fate that are completely outside of our control. So you could be the most responsible individual in the world, but if your husband is a drop-dead alcoholic, that becomes a problem, not only for you, but for your kids, for your parents, if you're, in charge of being a caretaker for them as well. So there was a lot of, sort of overlap between the notion of women's empowerment, and sort of freedom from this predatory liquor trade. And that's what's interesting about that is that, it's not just women who are pushing for this, but it's all sorts of, disaffected, disenfranchised populations around the globe. So, there's a tremendous overlap between, prohibitionism, suffragism, abolitionism in its early incarnations. What was fascinating was that, if you look at people like Frederick Douglass, who was probably the most famous temperance orator of his day. And his argument was that all great reforms go together, and that he meant abolition of the slave trade, women's rights, and temperance, because he saw those all as things that were keeping people from achieving their greater freedom.
Mark Schrott is author of Smashing the Liquor Machine. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.